This is Marshall Masters for Yowza.com. That's YOWUSA.com. And today we're going to cut to the chase with John DiNardo.
Suddenly I opened my eyes and I saw
Well, folks, here we are. It's less than 3 months to December 21, 2012. And at this stage of the game, it's going to be one of the following. Going to happen? Ain't going to happen. You is prepared? You ain't prepared. Just as simple as that. And for everybody that's sitting on the fence, well, there you be. As for me, I've really shifted my attention to the folks who are going to make it to the backside of this event. To me, the backside is, that's when we see blue skies once again. And the ones that are going to be more likely to make it to the backside than not will have been in some state of preparation and planning now for a good period of time. It's not something you can do on the job. But I know that there's a lot of you out there that just refuse to give up hope on the diehards who will never take it seriously, who mock you, ridicule you, and ignore you. Yet, what you're seeing cannot be mocked or ridiculed all that easily if someone takes the time to actually vet what you're saying. And in December, it's going to happen or it ain't going to happen. As simple as that. But for those of you who still want to try with those reluctant many, we've got John DiNardo. He's never slacked up an inch on this topic, not once. He's out there every day, writing emails, giving interviews, and doing what he can. And so for those of you that want to stuff your kit bag with some explanations that might just make a difference in this dwindling, small period of time, this interview's for you. So with that, let's get into it with John DiNardo.
Get a job, pay your taxes, pay your dues. You can live any way that you want to as long as you don't break any of their rules.
And this is Marshall, and I'm on with John DiNardo, Planet X researcher. And John, welcome back to Cut to the Chase.
Thank you for inviting me, Marshall.
Always fun to have you on. You're so filled with information. You know, I get your emails all the time, and you have a wide range of information that you follow. At top of the list are Planet X and Earth changes. And in this interview, I'm not interested in talking to people who haven't made up their minds about this yet. I will tell you, John, that I'm at peace with it. This is a twilight moment. It's kind of like playing roulette in Vegas, you know. That ball is spinning, but it hasn't started dropping. You got a little sliver of time. You could change your bet if you have any last-minute doubts. And I see that going on. And there's an awful lot of that. And frankly, it's just not interesting to me. Because that's all before event. My mind right now is after the event and helping those people. And all my efforts are focused in there. What I wanted to do with this with you, John, is that I know that we've got a lot of folks that follow our work out there, yours and mine. And for years, they've been pummeled by friends, family, and coworkers, either mocked and ridiculed for pursuing this information, or at the very best, just ignored. However, as knowledge sharers, that is going to change for them in time. And so they're going to be in a situation where they have to give a lot of information very quickly. And at that point, folks that are new to the topic are not going to have an interest in a discussion that goes back 3,600 years ago or even further. They're going to want to know what's happening today, how's it relevant to me today, period, what do I do about it, those kinds of things. And so since you're really out there beating the drum on this kind of information, I thought you'd be the go-to guy to give them all of that. And I think the first place we need to start with is what's happening in space.
Well, in space, what we have been seeing is increased solar activity because, as you know, there are the astrophysical reasons for it are that the sun is electrical in nature. Its solar winds are comprised of electrical particles that are blown out in all directions from the sun. Now, when the sun becomes hyperactive, causing it to emit flares that are unusually strong, coronal mass ejections that are, of course, always an anomaly, but now are becoming more frequent. When these solar electrical events occur, it is caused by excitations, just like as in electronics or in electricity. When you excite a circuit with a voltage or electrical current, you cause it to react. Now, this incoming bodies are drenched in plasma. This is a fact of science, and even the mainstream astrophysicists are coming around to accepting the electrical nature of the solar system. When incoming bodies from deep space penetrate the heliosphere far beyond the outer limits of our solar system, they pick up plasma. They become drenched in plasma, much like a bee flying into a bubblegum bubble would become engulfed in bubblegum.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that plasma, as it penetrates closer, as the incoming body gets closer to the center of the solar system, it begins to discharge not only toward the sun, but to some of the other planets. And as a result now, you've been discharging, well, to the sun, essentially, causing the sun to react much like a bug zapper. When a high electrical charge from beyond the sun strikes the sun, or surrounding comets begin to impact the sun, then the sun reacts like a sneeze, more or less, with an electrical sneeze, a solar flare. Now, where are these comets coming from? They are part of what astrophysicists know to be an entourage or a gang of bodies that is gravitationally captured by some large incoming body. It's more very much like a beehive coming in from deep space, and this beehive is encircled by swarms of bees. Well, this huge, what scientists have told us 30 years ago, they've detected it and reported it. They have stated that they believe it is a dwarf star. And a dwarf star is a baby star of extremely great mass. And because of its mass, it acts like a gravitational magnet, attracting thousands of comets and asteroids and meteors. And its journey from deep space through the outer bounds of our solar system and into the inner solar system. So all these comets, these bees swarming around it, begin to crash into the sun. Because, after all, the sun is a gravitational magnet far greater than this incoming celestial body, the mass.
Right, I understand, but we just had two impact events on Jupiter days apart that were quite substantial. Either one of those would have been an extinction-level event on Earth. And nonetheless, though, that's on Jupiter. And here on Earth, you're going to have people telling folks out there that want to share the knowledge, what second sun? What are you talking about? I'm looking up in the sky. I don't see nothing. Where are you pulling this nonsense out of? And they're going to have to deal with that. So, deal with it.
If we're at a point now, as you had described earlier to me, where this incoming body, which of course it's difficult to see because it is emitting only infrared light, it is not hot enough to actually ignite and emit visible light as our sun does. So it's emitting only infrared light. And that's a problem in visualizing it, in envisioning it right there. But there's an additional problem, as you had mentioned, and that is as Earth revolves around the sun, we're looking at this other object coming in from it's coming in from deep space into our solar system and is now believed to be around the outer solar system planets Saturn and Jupiter. All indications are that it may be around there because of the comet crashes that have occurred into Saturn. There have been extreme and extraordinary storms on Saturn over the last couple of years, and now we have comet impacts into Jupiter. Well, further right out from Jupiter is Saturn, and then the next planet in from Saturn is Jupiter. So naturally, we put the clues together, and we see that first there were impacts into Saturn causing storms, and now there are impacts into Jupiter. It indicates that this body is coming in. Now, however, when we revolve around the sun, we cannot see it because the sun is obstructing it.
Right. Someone's just going to say, well, that's the whole purpose of Jupiter being there, as far as we're concerned, as human beings. It's the big catcher's mitt of the universe.
Oh, yeah. Well, you say that Jupiter is like, people will say that Jupiter is a catcher's mitt for comets. That's when comets exist, yes, because Jupiter has a tremendous mass. Jupiter's mass is about 318 Earth masses, so it's like a gravitational magnet for comets if comets happen to be near Jupiter. But historically, we have never seen a comet impact into Jupiter until Comet Shoemaker-Levy crashed into Jupiter in 1993, I would believe, or somewhere in the 1990s. However, now we're seeing more comet impacts into Jupiter, which, you know, like in 2009, Anthony Wesley, an amateur astronomer, was lauded by NASA for discovering a comet impact into Jupiter in July 20th of 2009. Then about a year later, Anthony Wesley photographed another comet impact into Jupiter. So here you have two comet impacts within 2 years, which is extraordinary, considering they had never seen one before up until 1993. So here we're seeing evidence of a greater number of comets coming into our solar system than have ever before been detected. This is an indication that the huge beehive, that dwarf star, is bringing its gang, its swarm of bees, into or toward our inner solar system. Now, why would we assume that this massive body is coming in toward the sun at the center of our solar system? Simply because everyone knows that gravity works. Just as a meteor would, when captured by in the fringes of Earth's upper atmosphere, would be gravitationally accelerated to plunge into Earth. Likewise, an incoming body into our solar system would be gravitationally attracted by our sun to come in and toward our sun. In fact, look at the difference. Look at the tremendous, much greater gravitational pull that our sun exerts than our Earth would exert on a small meteor, because the mass of the sun is estimated to be about 1/3 of a million Earth masses. So we know by Newton's universal law of gravitation that the gravitational force of attraction, the magnitude of that gravitational force of attraction, is directly proportional to the mass of body A multiplied times the mass of body B. Body A being the sun, 1/3 of a million Earth masses. Body B being this dwarf star, which scientists call Planet X, which is about estimated conservatively to be about 1,000 Earth masses. So you have 1,000 Earth masses being attracted by 330,000 Earth masses of the sun. Mm-hmm. So naturally, gravity works, and I consider that my most powerful argument to show people that if that thing, that object, 1,000 Earth masses dwarf star, was detected in 1983, 30 years ago, by NASA, by NASA's infrared astronomical satellite, which it mm-hmm. was, and they stated in the New York Times landmark article that that object is indeed within the gravitational force field of our sun, then gravity, since gravity works, and we all know that, then this object has to be drawn in toward our sun, unless it is orbiting around the sun. And that's the only reason why Jupiter does not crash into the sun, because Jupiter is orbiting around the sun and Earth is orbiting around the sun. That's the only thing that prevents these planets or any object from crashing into that, being pulled in by that tremendous gravitational force field of the sun.
Okay, that's fine. But they're still going to ask the question, why in the hell don't we see it? If it's inside the solar system and it's supposed to be a second sun, there's a natural question that people ask, all right? Because they don't understand any of the concepts that you've just laid out. They just know what they can see with their own two eyes. And to them, it's like, well, if it's something about the size of a sun, why don't I see it right now?
Everyone has heard of infrared, infrared night vision. Everyone knows about that. If you're looking at an object at night, there's no light reflecting from it. You cannot see it unless you have an infrared mm-hmm. vision device.
But what about all of these two suns in the sky reports that are coming up?
You know, that's a good question. That I'll tell you what, mm-hmm. that's something that I have not studied. Now, if one thing I can tell you, right now, I believe it is far enough out that it's still infrared. But as it gets closer, we know, and this is a scientific fact, as it gets closer, it begins to become electrically excited mutually with the sun. And
right.
then it starts to glow, and then it starts to emit visible light. However, at this point, as we, most of us surmise that it is between Jupiter and Saturn, it's still emitting primarily, or most exclusively, infrared light. And that's why you cannot see it. But now give me your evidence, because I have not studied this, to indicate that, indeed, we do see two suns.
All right. Well, let's pick that up in the next segment.
Okay.
All right.
We'll get back to John in just a few minutes. But first, I'd like to talk a little bit about Yowza.com. Our site has always been a subscriber-supported site, although over 90% of the content has always been free to the public. For those of you who want to find information that's going to be useful in your own preparation and planning, this is a place. That's what we're devoted to here, is to helping people survive. It's not about being right, folks. It's about getting it right. So check out our subscription plans and see if there's one that fits the bill. And if it does, that's great. We sure could use the help, and you could use the information. Now with that, let's get back into it with John. Well, John, in the last segment, we were talking about these sundog cell phone photos. And I've been following this. People have been getting these photos. I've been interested in the ones particularly that are taken at altitude by folks on commercial air flights because they're above the chemtrail layer. And they're using smartphones, cell phones, Blackberries, and so forth. And what we find is that they will observe two suns in the sky. People on the ground observe two suns in the sky. Most of this is quite handily debunked by folks that just say, well, it's a reflection, it's a sun dog, it's whatever. But I found some interesting patterns in it, and I'm not so quick to throw it off. First off, we're seeing legitimate people coming forward and reporting this. And for years, I'd say dating back to 2003, I saw a lot of cell phone sun dog photos being put out there by elitist disinformationists to inoculate people so that they would say, yeah, it's a cell phone sun dog, and to immediately discount any new reports that come along. However, these people that are filing reports with us, they come forward. If I say, all right, you were on a flight, prove you were on the flight, send me a copy of your e-ticket, I get a copy of the e-ticket. You know, there's no more of this hit-and-run fruiter nonsense. They stand and deliver. They answer the questions. I think it's important. But always this controversy is boiling around cell phones. And in researching that, I think the reason why cell phones are picking this up more than people with professional cameras is deals with the auto exposure mode on cell phones. If you have a nice new Nikon or something, it's going to find a good balance of aperture and speed. How much light is it letting in and how quickly does it take the picture? With cell phones, you have cameras that are about 3x5 millimeters in size. They're very small. On some of the newer cameras, they're much more elegant, like the iPhone, which has like a 5-element lens, which is rather very sophisticated for that size. It's why it has that beautiful high-definition resolution. But it doesn't matter if you have an iPhone or a BlackBerry. All of these are going to be using an exposure setting of f2.4 or f2.6, somewhere in that range. And in terms of like a regular movie camera or a home camera, this is letting in huge amounts of light, just huge amounts of light. And I think that's the reason why these cell phones are picking up things that other cameras are not. However, when people are at altitude, they're looking through a triple pane window and it's going to be gas filled. Well, that causes reflections, and that's where the debunkers always go initially, is they immediately blow it off that way. However, we have found imagery where people did see a second sun, which did turn out to be a reflection generated in the aircraft window. However, in one case, we found an uncatalogued object, which was probably causing that reflection. And my thinking on it right now, in terms of my book, Crossing the Cusp and Where Planet X Should Be in According to the Orbit Given in That Formation, it would put it at a place where perhaps it is rather far out there, as you were saying before, as an infrared object, but its satellites will be closer. So it could be reflections coming off the satellites that are going to be much closer to the sun. There could be any number of things happening, but I think for me, the huge shift is that I see honest people coming forward with honest reports to talk about this. And of course, they're being discounted quite easily. Now, in December, it'll be a different thing. In December, it'll start becoming naked eye visible. We're going to get out of this twilight zone. That is, if it's coming. Now, and as I said at the beginning of the show, hey, gonna happen, ain't gonna happen. All right. You is prepared or you ain't prepared. And that's all there is to it. But anyway, in this one, John, let's now focus on Earth changes and what you're seeing. Because for me, this has always been the hot button issue. And the things that I'm seeing, you know, are screaming something's coming. But tell me what you're seeing.
Well, I and other people who are following the Earth changes are seeing increased activity with earthquakes. And I would ask people to write down or remember the name of a particular website that has a very good visual map of the entire Earth and displays earthquakes very graphically and colorfully. And that would be one that's seismon.edu. That's seismon.edu.
Yeah, it's a good site. I use it.
And when you go there, it's very neat because it uses a circle to display a particular earthquake, and the diameter, the larger the circle, the greater the magnitude of the earthquake that the circle is indicating.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the color of the circle, if it's yellow, that means the earthquake occurred in the last 2 weeks. And of course, so if you look at a lot of yellow or red, yellow and red circles, which are very recent within 2 weeks, you can judge day by day the changes. Just as you look at a wife or a son day by day, you know exactly what he looks like.
Right.
And if something happens or if he's getting sick and his complexion changes, you begin to notice that he's not the same, doesn't look the same, or she doesn't look the same as she normally does. That's because you're used to looking at that person day after day. Likewise, if you go to seismon.edu day after day, and you get a visual memory of what is that particular earthquake intensity of all the earthquakes forming around the Pacific Ocean, the Ring of Fire,
mm-hmm.
and which encompasses the California, Western U.S. border and the Western Canadian border up around north around Alaska and down along the eastern border of Asia, you begin to look at that and see how it looks day by day, and you notice changes in activity. The yellow blotches become stronger, and you say you can immediately see that you're getting an increase in activity. You'll notice down around Indonesia, there's always a tremendous amount of activity in the South Pacific,
yeah.
North of Australia. You get a visual memory of what normalcy looks like,
mm-hmm.
in terms of earthquake activity there. So I'm seeing an increase because of my daily observations. But if you go to the charts, you'll see the same thing on the tables, which are, of course, not very visually interpretive, but you can look at all the 6.2s, which are considered very large, strong. 6.0 on up to higher number magnitudes are becoming more and more frequent when you look at the USGS charts and tables. Even though USGS will downplay the magnitudes, so that, for example, for 30 years or so, after Dr. Richter mysteriously died, well, he was 85 years old, I understand. But they tried to get him to change the earthquake scale so that earthquakes didn't appear to be numerically as serious as they actually are, to make them look milder than they are. He would not do it.
Mm-hmm.
And within a month or so after he died, within about a month after he died, they changed the scale.
Mm.
And so you've got a lot of indications, but let's get it back to earthquake activity. We're seeing a lot more earthquake activity. Everyone that I interface with on this subject who studies earthquakes is telling me, yes, I mean, it's getting obviously more intense. But here's a really powerful piece of information that comes directly from the United States federal government. The U.S. Geological Survey, 2 days ago, they had a report that was highly publicized. It was on the Weather Channel, September 26th. A USGS spokesman, Fred Politz, came on and said, we have seen two major earthquakes in April 11th, in the Indian Ocean.
Mm-hmm.
Those two earthquakes, one was an 8.2 magnitude, the other was an 8.6.
Mm-hmm.
He made the outrageous, but yet very revealing statement that those two earthquakes in April in the Indian Ocean 6 months ago have set the entire crust of the Earth into vibration, such that now all the tectonic junctures and earthquake fault lines are trembling, vibrating, and his very clear implication was that therefore we can expect to see some very intense and frequent earthquakes from here on out. Mm-hmm. Now, there you go. That's from the USGS. But here's a fly in the ointment that would actually lead us logically to realize that we're getting even more information concealed than is being revealed.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, they gave us a phony reason. Those two earthquakes could never cause the entire earth to go into trembling. In other words, let me give you an example. If I look at my kitchen cabinets and I see the cabinets vibrating, and I open a cabinet door and two glasses vibrate and slip off the shelf and crash to the floor,
mm-hmm.
would I be illogical to, wouldn't it be very illogical to say that the crashing of those two glasses on the floor has caused all the other glasses still on the shelf to vibrate? No. That's like saying that the effect causes the cause. No. In physics, there is a cause and there's an effect. The vibration is what caused the two glasses to fall in the first place, and the continuing vibration is what's causing other glasses, putting in other glasses in danger of falling.
Okay, but in this area that you're talking about, recently you had an 8.0, and it didn't happen on a fault line. It happened in the middle of a plate. Thankfully, there was no tsunami generated by that. But how do we wind up getting an 8.0 in the middle of a plate, not at its edges?
There has to be an incredible amount, incredibly tremendous amount of force, mm-hmm. stress acting on that plate in order to cause it to shear, or actually fracture.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as you and I know, and as for even laymen know who don't study the subject, they realize that earthquakes almost always occur where the cracks or separations between tectonic plates already exist on the fault line. That's where because of the stresses on the Earth's crust causing the plates to rub laterally against one another or to rub vertically against one another. Mm-hmm. Either way, it's always at a fault juncture. But in this case, it's extremely worrisome to know that there was such a tremendous pressure on the Earth's crust that it actually caused the plate to crack and in an earthquake. I mean, this is scary. That's all I can say.
I think it definitely speaks to that there's a major movement in the tectonic plates. There's no question about that.
I mean, the pressure could be coming, is evidently coming from beneath the surface, beneath the crust, below the lithosphere of the Earth, the crust and the undercrust, and down into the more viscous pudding-like mantle of the Earth, which is molten rock. When that stresses begin to act on a fluid substance such as the Earth's mantle, those stresses, the fluid mantle then begins to stretch the more solid crust above it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you would get the breakage because of some kind of force. It could be probably, from everything we've seen, it's heating of the Earth's core.
All right. But folks that are just coming to this and they're you know, shooting from the hip, they're going to say, well, how could an object out in space be causing an 8.0 in Sumatra?
Okay.
In the middle of a plate.
Okay, what happens is the sun becomes extremely excited over a long period of time, and we have the data. The data is quite, it's cut and dry. It's indisputable. The data shows that the sun has been hyperactive over the average sun activity has been much, much greater over the last decade than it had been in previous decades.
Mm-hmm.
As a result, now, how does the sun get active? We already spoke about that, but just to recap it again, when objects entering, especially plasma-drenched objects, which are electrified, enter our solar system from deep space, they excite the sun by discharging the solar capacitor, which is the proton sphere, or the heliosphere, that surrounds the outer solar system, and they discharge it back to the sun. So that's a capacitor discharging, just like in electricity. We use a capacitor with a separation of charge, negative on one side and positive on the other. Well, the sun is primarily negative. It has a space charge of electrons, an excess of electrons, and it blows out many more massive protons, which causes a deficiency in protons. Those protons go to the outer circle, like sort of like a sugar coating on a huge beach ball.
Mm-hmm.
And the beach ball being the outer heliosphere surrounding our solar system. Well, when objects come in, they cause a discharge of the protons from the heliosphere way out there toward the center of the solar system back to the sun. That zaps the sun, just like a bug zapper would be zapped in between the electrified plates of a bug zapper. Well, the sun then, because of the exciting the zap that it just received, it spits it back out again. It's electrical reaction, and the sun's reaction is in the form of solar flares, coronal mass ejections, solar winds. All of these are electrified particles, and X-rays, of course, high energy, electromagnetic energy, as well as particles. Those particles then blast out in all directions. It's a solar sneeze. And it goes out in all directions, impacts the Earth, of course, and the Earth's magnetic field gets blasted, and we've seen distortion of the Earth's magnetic field. Well, what does that do? When you take any magnetic field and you interfere with it or pump energy into it, which is electrical, though that moving blast of solar energy that hits the Earth, because the particles are in motion, they themselves, the trail of particles sneezed out by the sun actually generates a magnetic field. This is a common principle of physics, and it's the basis upon the principle upon which all electric motors work.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, you have electrical charge current going through a motor winding. What happens? Surrounding the motor winding coil is an intense magnetic field. It's called an electromagnetic field, resulting from moving charge. Likewise, the moving charge of the solar particles sneezed out by the sun generate the same kind of electromagnetic field that impinges upon Earth's magnetic field, just as you would taking a chopstick, for example, and poking it through the wire bars of a bird cage.
Mm-hmm.
Earth is like a bird cage. The vertical wire bars surrounding the Earth are comparable or analogous to the Earth's invisible magnetic field. So when this magnetic chopstick, so to speak, pokes through the Earth's rotating bird cage bars, it generates a conflicting or feedback magnetic field into the Earth's magnetic field, which feeds back to the core, just like the core of an apple. Well, that core is Earth's solid iron and molten, solid metal and molten metal core. That's how the Earth's core gets heated up. I've just given you the basic chain of events. Incoming object electrically excites the sun. The sun sneezes out with electrical particles, which in turn create electromagnetic energy blasting to the Earth, feeding back through the Earth's magnetic field, the outer balloon of the Earth's magnetic field, in toward to the center of the Earth.
All right. Well, then in that event, what I want to do when we come back in the third segment is I want to ask you about all of this solar activity as it pertains to something we can observe, which is the fact that airports are having to repaint their runways. All right, so let's come back for that one. With me?
Yes.
Okay.
Should I say what I'm thinking now? Should I speak what I'm hearing about? Should I cross the...
You know, folks, I bet some are out there wondering if I've just lost interest in the topic, and that's the reason why I'm not as active in terms of doing radio and publishing as I was before. No, I haven't done that. To be honest with you folks, I know that there's a residual period of time here that's dwindling. A time to plan, prepare, work ahead, think ahead, and to take a few moments to go out and enjoy this beautiful blue-green world of ours. Because over 25 years ago, I was given a prophetic vision of what's coming. It's not going to be pretty. I see a defoliated planet and people who are so beset by misery that they really don't care if they live or die. And it is this vision that was given to me so many years ago, which I describe fully in my work, 2012 Wisdom of the Elohim, that has always propelled me to stay engaged and to do the work. But I also must admit that the problem with prophetic visions is that it's hard to duplicate it for somebody else. You just see what you see, you know what you know, and you go accordingly. Essentially, you just have to decide whether or not you're going to trust yourself. I made that decision to trust myself a long time ago, and I've never regretted it. And if nothing happens in December, and folks, I truly hope that is the case, then I look forward to hearing the world laughing at my expense. It is not to see or to experience the things I have been writing about for over a decade. And with that, let's get back into it for our final segment with John DiNardo.
I'll give me something to hold on to as a venture.
And I'm back on with John. And John, in the last segment, you really gave a very good explanation of how solar activity is causing Earth changes here on Earth. But it's also something where, you know, people need something that's right up in their face that they can see. If we're talking about tectonic plates in the Sumatra area on the other side of the world, that's kind of hard for folks to notice. But on the other hand, if we're talking about something you could see at your local airport, where they're having to repaint the numbers on the end of the runway because magnetic north is changing and it's really speeding up. So connect the dots, if you will, between the explanation you gave about increased solar activity in the last segment, and in this segment, marry that to what is happening, that we're having to repaint the numbers on the end of the runways now.
Yes. Well, the Earth's magnetic field, again, you can compare it to an apple. The core of an apple is that's the mm-hmm. source of the Earth's magnetic field.
Mm-hmm.
Those invisible magnetic lines go up, just like through the outer core of an apple, and surround the Earth like the skin of the apple
mm-hmm.
would surround the flesh of the apple.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you have disturbances, magnetic disturbances, what happens to the core of the Earth? Now it's getting blasted. As a result, well, first, what you have is a core, and I guess maybe a good way to describe the Earth would be to give you a vision of something very delicious, and that might be a chocolate ball. The outside of the chocolate is solid chocolate. The inside, below the solid outer shell, is a more creamy caramel type of, well, creamy kind of chocolate, and that would be the Earth's mantle.
It's a round M&M.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
It's very deep. The mantle is viscous, though, like pudding, chocolate pudding.
All right.
Now, beneath that, the mantle comprises the greatest mass of the Earth, actually. But it goes very deep, beneath the outer crust. So, but you go down toward the center of the Earth, now below all that chocolate pudding, and you wind up with, get to the center, there is a liquid, molten metal. We'll compare that to, say, cherry, a cherry syrup that you find inside these chocolate candies. And at the very center, inside of that cherry syrup, might be an almond. The cherry syrup is called the Earth's outer core, liquid outer core. The almond is the Earth's inner solid core. Both are comprised of metal. One is, the inner core is solid metals, you know, largely iron. The outer core is the same kind of material. It's hard to say because nobody's ever been there, but the outer core is metal also. So, which of course, it makes it very, very magnetic.
Right.
Now, you don't get a magnetic field. You do not get a magnetic field at temperatures that are as hot as the Earth's core. It cannot be a magnet, because we know that if we take a regular solid bar magnet and heat it up in a fire and get it hot enough, it will lose its magnetism. However, we do get a magnetic field from the aligned atoms, these molten iron atoms that revolve. They swirl around just like a bowl of water in a potter's, in a clay pot on a potter's wheel. The potter's wheel is spinning slowly. The water, consequently, is swirling around constantly. As long as that water inside the spinning bowl is not disturbed, and as long as the potter's wheel is not nudged or thrown off balance, that water will spin nice and smoothly. As the water spins smoothly around its outer edges, that is up along the upper edges of the bowl, the motion of those aligned metal atoms creates an electromagnetic field, just like the one that I described before, with current going through a wire. Well, just visualize it as a liquid wire that's swirling. An electric charge is traveling in a big circle, like a big merry-go-round, around the inside of the bowl, and that is generating a magnetic field. That's the magnetic field that billows up and encompasses the entire Earth like the core of an apple and the skin of the apple emanating from the core all the way around. It's the swirling motion. Now, what happens to the Earth's smoothly spinning molten iron core when it's disturbed with all these blasts of solar winds, electrified particles, as we know, in motion, generating electromagnetic disturbances that are blasting Earth's magnetic field? Now you have a disruption in that smooth flow of molten iron inside the Earth's core, and it's beginning to slosh around now. At the same time, there is a very real possibility, and this was given to me by a psychic, a guy who only has a high school education, but he gets basically ideas. And I believe in prophecy.
All right.
I believe that people have psychic abilities. We've seen it with Edgar Cayce. We've seen it with hundreds of people.
Right.
In the past history and to this day. Now, this man gets these ideas, and he had told me that he has a strong feeling that the Earth's solid iron core has been thrown off center. Now, that would explain why I'm seeing these weird jet stream patterns on the Weather Channel. If you look at the National Weather Service weather maps, you'll see the jet stream of the Earth undulating like a roller coaster, going from Canada all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico, up and down. It never used to do that.
You go on CNN or any other networks, and they're going to talk about the droughts and how this is related to all that. And I would actually say, of all the networks that I've been watching for Earth Changes Information, CBS Evening News has done a very remarkable job of tracking the effects of the drought, just focusing attention on that one thing. And so what you're talking about is the reason why the drought is happening in the first place. Is that right?
Yes, because the jet stream, when the jet stream, let's say now it looks like a W, that's what it's been looking like. Capital W. If you visualize a map of Canada, the United States, and Mexico with a huge W superimposed on it, now that W has gotten higher in amplitude.
Yeah.
Such that the peak of the W back in, according to all the videotapes that I've been taping from the Weather Channel, the peak of the W used to be somewhere around the U.S.-Canadian border. And the trough of the W used to be somewhere around Texas, Louisiana. And that W would slide from west to east slowly over a period of a few days, sliding W. Then, as from 2009 to the present, the W got extremely large, such that it was no longer peak to peak from the Canadian border to the Mexican border, but now the upper peak is from Alaska, the southern peak is down into the Caribbean Sea, and the width of the W has likewise increased, such that it doesn't encompass just the United States. It encompasses the Pacific Ocean, the United States, the Americas, and parts of the Atlantic Ocean. So that W has gotten very large. And that very much coincides or agrees with the theory that my friend is telling me, and that we know also between his information or his psychic information and what we know happens electrically to the Earth's molten iron core when it's disturbed. You get a sloshing of that swirling molten iron core. At the same time, you get the solid inner core, that almond within the candy. And the almond begins to shift off-center. Now, you've got a whole change in the magnetic, the direction of that magnetic field. Because now the swirling has changed and the core is throwing it off such that it's no longer swirling smoothly, but it's sloshing. And that's why you got that undulation. Nobody has ever presented this theory. No one that I know of.
You know, given that nobody's gone down there with a Kodak Instamatic and got a few snaps of the core, I guess anything's fair game. But I think at this point, we've got about 5 minutes left, and I'd like to talk about the Great Deception, why people are not seeing it, and some are. This is what I've been seeing going on for many, many years, is this Great Deception. How does it manifest for you in what you've observed?
Well, I communicate, I try to stay spiritual. We all know that there is a creator. I mean, most everyone who is open-minded and looks at the world around them objectively knows that we've been created because of the great beauty and fantastic symmetry and organization of not only the world around us, but we ourselves, our bodies are just a miracle. And it's a miracle of love that's been given to us. You know, the stereo vision, we have two eyes to give us stereo vision. We have two ears to give us stereo hearing. We have a sense of smell. We have a sense of taste. We have wonderful tasting fruits, etc. You could go on for hours describing all the wonder and the symmetry and the beauty that has been given to us by a creator. Well, I try to stay in tune with that, with our creator in my spirit, just walk with him. And as a result, I become more open-minded. And I see that there is also a force of evil that is militating toward deceiving the people. Yes, there is something to the yin and the yang. There's something to the two opposites, evil and good. There is something to truth to that principle, that there is a force of good and a force of evil. The force of evil would like people to be disconnected from the truth and to fall to their death because of their ignorance. And this is this deception that I see. And when you look at the power elite and the evil that is rising from the rulers of the world, the monolithic rulership of this world that we're seeing emerge, you begin to see it in everyone. No one can deny it at this point, that there is an intense form of evil that's rising to deceive everyone. So it's a spiritual thing. Now, to bring it to the physical level where people may be skeptical about that principle that I'm describing to them, we can see that the power elite, being selfish, do not want to tell the people about the disasters that are to come. Why? Because for centuries, for eons, they have maintained their control over the people by secrecy, by keeping the public ignorant, and by knowing the secrets of how to rule and deceive the public. For example, with the stock market, they'll never tell you when the stock market's going down. They'll tell you to buy when it's ready to crash, and they'll tell you to sell when it's ready to go up. That's how they make their money. Any stock market analyst will tell you that. So these people are out to deceive you. So when you hear the mass media, which is owned and operated by the power elite, you can check out their ownership, who owns all the big networks. It's the big banking cartels. When you see these wealthy people telling you that there's nothing to worry about, you know that you're being deceived. And it's very dangerous, too, because to believe a person who is treacherous, duplicitous, and evil, which we are seeing demonstrated, their evil and their duplicity, to believe them is to commit suicide. Especially when disasters are coming on the earth and you see all the signs with the earthquakes and floods and the crazy phenomena such as haboobs, windstorms, I mean dust storms that are like a half mile high, happening once a week practically in Arizona, when you see all this strange weather, and yet the power elite say, don't worry, but yet they're going into their underground shelters. We've got film of their underground cities. Governor Jesse Ventura, it's all documented on television, on True TV channel. They went into the underground cities, and these things are multi-billion dollar facilities where the elite plan to go to protect themselves from probably what is going to be what the scientists, even NASA, and astrophysicists like Dr. Michio Kaku, but NASA are telling us that the sun is going to become increasingly active and intense, and it's going to cause such solar blasting that there may be widespread death, might be extreme temperatures that are going to cause widespread death on the planet. And the first sign they're telling us would be the destruction of our power grids. And you're hearing this. Now, they're keeping it low key, of course, because they don't want to disturb the public. They don't want to panic the public until they can duck underground themselves.
This, John, is about Titanic rules. That's it. It's Titanic rules. First class gets the boats. Steerage goes down with the ship. We're steerage. When the Titanic was sinking, they locked the gates so that people in steerage couldn't even get out of the ship to fight for their lives. And that mentality has translated to today. And the simple fact of it is, there's not enough food on the planet to feed 7 billion people through a global disaster. There is going to be a lot of death and destruction. And from the viewpoint of the elites, they're going to go into their bunkers, they're going to disappear. And the fewer people that are left to survive all of this, the easier for them to manage the world afterwards. In the meantime, if we really don't know what's going on, and it's all suppressed, it makes their getaway ever so much easier, doesn't it?
Well, it sure does. And just look at the coming economic collapse and find out who's telling you the truth and who's lying to you. They're not telling you the truth that they're ready to crash the dollar. They're waiting for you to be left holding the bag because they're buying up all the gold. And we're talking about those who are globally wealthy, those who are royalty.
Mm-hmm.
Some are British, Dutch royalty.
They're buying the gold, but I'll tell you what, if you don't physically hold the gold in your hands, you don't have gold. You have a piece of paper. And right now, with these bullion banks and everything that's going on, I would lay good odds that everybody that's sitting there and holding a piece of paper that says you have a bar of gold, they're going to find out that they're not the only ones that have a piece of paper laying a claim to the same bar of gold. What's happening here is a lot of manipulation. But, you know, let's then get this down to a final thought, if you will, to those out there who've looked at the noise, looked at the craziness, been able to look beyond that craziness and to see the hard facts that are out there. And they are going to very soon face a real possibility in December of having to explain all of this very suddenly to a whole lot of people who are going to say, why in the hell are we the last ones to know? I want you to give me a 30-second answer as to why we are the last to know.
Well, we've got a very small clique of wealthy people who rule the world who've never given the truth to the people. Why should they change now? They've always lied to us about the stock market, lied to us about our ability to succeed in this world, and put us into a state where we work for them and we support them. So naturally, they're going to continue with the same their same nature, and that is to lie to us while they duck underground for shelter and then let the rest of us die so that they could thin out the population. There will be no rebellion because most of the people will be killed on the surface by the solar blasts. And when they come up from their underground cities, they hope, they're crossing their fingers with a lot of doubt, they're coming up and they'll have a few people to be their slaves. And that's the answer as to why we're the last to know.
And you know, it's a simple truth, and it's so simple, 99.9% of the world will never believe it until it befalls them. This has been a tremendous interview, John, and let's just keep working on staying prepared.
Thank you, Marshall.
Thanks.
Take my hand, I won't turn away. Life's too short to play these games.
Well, I think you can agree that John DiNardo comes at the topic with intensity and knowledge. The question is there enough intensity and enough knowledge to get people off the dime with preparation and planning? Well, hopefully he's accomplished some of that today. Maybe we have helped a few of you out there that are trying to get some family and friends and coworkers off the dime just to start some kind of planning and preparation. But if not, I'd like to leave you with one thought, especially for those of you who follow the topic but you haven't been doing planning and preparation. Don't let anybody knock you down for not planning and preparing. If you know what's coming, could be that the reason why you were born, you came into this life, or incarnated, however you want to call it, was that you would have this knowledge so that when the great dying happens, you will be able to help people understand on the day they die from natural calamities that are going to ensue, to understand why, to help them make a better transition back to the other side. Is there a reward for that? Not really. You're not going to have any better chance of surviving than the people who are unprepared and haven't seen it coming. But then again, that's probably not your mission. Your mission is to impart this knowledge before you die. And for those of you who want to go a little further, the clock's ticking. The grocery stores are going to get more expensive. These droughts are really whacking the country. Economic forecasts are showing that it's actually slowed the recovery, if we could call it that. So, time is wasting. If you're going to stockpile, do it now. And I'll leave it on that note. So until the next time we meet, remember Marshall's motto. Destiny comes to those who listen and fate finds the rest.
So learn what you can learn, do what you can do, and never give up hope. And this is Marshall, and I'll catch you on the backside.